Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Today, I'm joined with the man that needs no introduction, Pierre Richard. Before I bring him on stage, I want to give a shout out to the awesome Bitcoin company that powers the show, SwanBitcoin.com, best place to buy Bitcoin, built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They incentivize dollar cost averaging, self-custody. If you haven't already done so, visit swanbitcoin.com today. I want to bring up Pierre. Pierre, thank you so much for joining us. It looks like you're experimenting with the many Bitcoin backgrounds.
Yeah, that's all right. Thanks for having me on. It's excited to be here.
I'm excited. Look, so Pierre, and I know
you know. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin.
It's playing in the background. I'm sorry about that. Rookie mistake. Anyways, Pierre, sure, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think that once you go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, you come to so many understandings, like you learn something new. Like it's, you know, and my current rabbit hole is, holy crap, this inflation thing is a scam. Is it really necessary for economies to work? I had the privilege to have Lynn and Jeff, and this is the first question I asked them right off the rip, is inflation necessary? So we could talk about that a little bit later, but where are you in your Bitcoin rabbit hole experience? What realizations and understandings and things have you been ruminating in your mind as of late? Like that you're just like, holy cow, this is crazy, because I don't think I've ever met one person, including OGs, that have really reached the bottom of this rabbit hole. It's always a new realization, you know, and it's funny because we all kind of collide and we reach a similar conclusion, but we're all coming at it from different angles, different experiences in life. So where are you in your Bitcoin rabbit hole journey? And what things have you been thinking about as of late?
Yeah, a realization I had yesterday, and maybe others have, this might be obvious to others, but is that multi-sig allows custody to be decentralized. And this wasn't aspect of decentralization in regards to Bitcoin that I'd really put much thought into. And once that got into my head, contrasted with gold being centralized at Fort Knox, that really the most secure way of custodying Bitcoin is not by putting it all in one basket and, you know, surrounding it by the US military, but rather by doing a multi-sig and hiding the private keys in, you know, discrete locations. That's that was something that I had not really internalized, even if I'd perhaps heard about it from others before.
So what is it that it makes you so fascinating about that subject? Because I went down that rabbit hole, the game theory of geographically separating your seeds. You can even do it in different jurisdictions. Right, you can have fun with it. Some of those seeds can have a 25th word. Like, there's so many things that you could do. It could be a 2 of 3, 3 of 5. I'm a big fan of the 2 of 3. I think 3 of 5 is, you know, because if you overcomplicate security, it can hurt you just as bad as having too little security. So what are your thoughts on that? Like, what led you down that path that you found that so fascinating?
Yeah, I mean, as part of providing kind of the Bitcoin 101 almost every week for the past 4 years, I'd always talked about multi-sig, but it was the first time that I'd kind of said, this is decentralized custody, because I still had it in mind that, you know, I guess I'd never used that terminology for multi-sig. And also, I do want to say that there's a lot to be said for single sig as well. So I'm not saying that multi-sig is the only way or anything like that, but it does completely change the kind of the equilibrium outcome over the long term. I think one of the challenges is that over the short term, a common way that people acquire Bitcoin is by purchasing it on a centralized exchange and then just by pure momentum, leaving it there. Not because it's complicated to self-custody, but rather because that's the easy path is, you know, from my point of view, if you look at the hurdles involved in setting up a hardware wallet versus setting up an exchange account and securing a hardware wallet and securing an exchange account, hardware wallets actually orders of magnitude easier than an exchange account. It's just that in order to buy Bitcoin, one has to start by, or, you know, generally the path that people go through is setting up and securing an exchange account. They feel like they have enough kind of economic exposure to Bitcoin and they don't follow through on setting up that hardware wallet. Maybe that'll change in the future. It would be really cool if the default path was like that you buy a hardware wallet and then from there you buy Bitcoin. I know that some of the hardware wallet manufacturers now bundle in the ability to buy Bitcoin into their desktop software that they connect, and that might be what the angle that Swan's going in with their acquisition of Spectre. So that's really cool. I'll leave it there before I keep rambling.
No, it is a fascinating conversation because you have for example, it not only Swan seems to be heading in that direction, right? Casa, right? Added, but they started in the opposite direction. They started with a multi-sig, type of solution, collaborative custody. And then they're like, hey, why don't we just add Bitcoin purchases? And then Unchained seems to be falling down that rabbit hole as well. So all coming to the kind of the same realization of making it as easy as possible for the user, with a click of a button to at least take advantage of the security benefits of multi-sig, but without jumping all through these hoops, right? And I think the reality is like, okay, for Opti producer in the background, Pierre, myself, okay, cold card, let's do it, right? But I think for the average person, it's specifically the people that have spent the majority of their lives in the fiat matrix, I would make the argument, Pierre, that sending a wire is more complex than taking self-custody, but crossing that initial bridge could seem daunting to a lot of people. Does it worry you at all, what I call the self-custody aspect? Because the reality is that if the way that I change is individuals taking, if enough people do, if people don't do it, I think it's just a continuation of the system that we've lived for so long, right? They manipulate it, as the case with FTX blowing up, they were selling Bitcoin they didn't have. So does that worry you a little bit, the self-custody aspect? And I know there's been solutions like Fediments, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, so I just see it as with many other parts of Bitcoin, that it's anti-fragile. So if people, F around, they find out. So if they, leave their coins at Celsius, FTX, BlockFi, whatever it is, they find out why they weren't supposed to do that. So I'm not really worried about a situation where, this problem is spiraling out of control and, nobody's holding their own Bitcoin. The other point I would argue is that all of the Bitcoin are currently being self-custodied, meaning that if you leave your Bitcoin at Coinbase, Coinbase is self-custodying their Bitcoin, and what you have is an IOU. So it's not like if you're comfortable holding an IOU, and that's on you. But if then Coinbase goes belly up, there should definitely be clarity about the fact that you never held Bitcoin, and maybe it'll take a bankruptcy judge to get you to understand that. But yeah, I think that the smart way to go about life in general is to learn from other people's mistakes. But I think that lots of people are going to learn the hard way by making the mistake themselves. And that's just the way life is. It's not really something that worries me per se.
Yeah, 100% sometimes. And you know, that's the case right now so far, right? You see these record amount of outflows going out of the exchanges. And it's exactly for what you just said, Pierre, which is people got spooked.
Yep.
People got spooked and they realized not your keys, not your Bitcoin. So
also, yeah, the other thing I would add is that, like, we don't have to push self-custody and, like, you know, be hand-wringing over it, because there are actual businesses built around self-custody. So you mentioned Casa, Unchained, Ledger, Trezor, Cold Card. So their marketing department is doing the heavy lifting for us, right? They are the ones advertising, hey, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. I don't feel like there's a gap here where if the community doesn't get together and push self-custody that we're going to have problems. It's like, no, there's profit-making businesses that are going to, that are incentivized to promote self-custody.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that I really believe that it's just going to become more seamless over time.
Yeah.
So Pierre, what are your thoughts on, you know, the demonization, right? And, you know, you've heard politicians come up with terms like unhosted wallet, right? As if, you know, the hosted wallet is the normal version and the unhosted wallet is some, you know, some form of weird, you know, shadowy supercoder, so dangerous to society, somehow holding your own wealth is, you know, is dangerous. What are your thoughts on that? And then connect that question with the recent bill that was introduced by Senator Marshall and Senator Elizabeth Warren that really showed their cards, right? It would have forced I don't know how this would be enforceable, but it would have forced developers in the United States to register with the state in order to write code for Bitcoin. Like, it's so absurd, but I think it really shows that this thing really freaks them out. They're scared, right? So what are your thoughts on that, Pierre?
Yeah, so I think that it is a very small minority of them who are scared and freaked out and proposing these bad policies. The supermajority, and it's a bipartisan supermajority of policymakers, understand three things. One, the reality is that self-hosted wallets, right? People holding their own private keys. That is what, you know, folks might call investors or savers. And that's what the data reflects. Even from, if you go look at Chainalysis's public reports, they're pretty clear about the fact that the folks accumulating on their own keys are doing so for investment or saving reasons. Criminals don't care about Bitcoin as an investment or as a savings vehicle. In fact, quite the opposite. They are in an urgent hurry to get out of Bitcoin and into fiat and, you know, to spend their fiat, right? Like, criminals are high time preference, meaning that they're not thinking about, oh, how do I increase my purchasing power in 10 years, right? By definition, these people are thinking very short term, and they are trying to realize fiat gains, right? They're fiat maxis criminals. So that means that criminals, whenever they get proceeds in Bitcoin, immediately try to convert it into fiat. And that's actually, if we look at all the examples of them getting caught, that's why they get caught. And there's just a litany of cases where the criminal takes the Bitcoin, deposits it at a regulated exchange, a hosted wallet, right? And because they want to convert it to dollars or euros, dollars and euros are the favorite currency of criminals. They don't like Bitcoin. It's too volatile, right? They, you know, for all the same reasons that the skeptics have. That's the first thing. The second is that the people, the honest people who are accumulating Bitcoin as savings, you know, on their own keys, these people are, one, they're not criminals, and two, they are voters, right? They're upstanding citizens, and policymakers understand that if they enact bad policies that punish honest, innocent savers and have zero effect on criminals, right? Because that these policies would have zero effect on criminals, that they are alienating voters and donors, right? And so it's really in the self-interest of politicians and regulators to look at the data and to you know, accept the reality that these self-hosted wallets are you know, for completely legitimate purposes, and there's no reason at all to be focused in on them if the policy goal is to punish criminals. So that, and then lastly, that a crackdown on self-hosted wallets is entirely futile. What a self-hosted wallet is just, it's math. So they can't ban math. They can't ban open source software. So it's just a bad policy and ineffective policy. And that's why there's a very tiny minority of policymakers who make lots of noise about it, but they're not serious people. They are destroying their credibility by engaging in, you know, tilting at windmills and, you know, concocting fantasies about, you know, something that's just not reality.
Yeah, absolutely. It's futile, but I think a lot of these politicians have been used to living in a world where, you know, they snap their finger and just basically things happen, right? And
I would argue again, it's not a lot of them. It's a tiny handful of them who have this mentality. The majority of them are looking at this as innovative technology. Let's see where it goes. That every new technology, you know, sometimes gets used by criminals, right? You know, that was the case with the internet. That was the case with cars. And so they're, you know, understanding is that there's legitimate use cases for Bitcoin, and that there's, that's the supermajority view, that, and there's, you know, a tiny handful of politicians who I think not only are they kind of loud in their rhetoric, but I also think that they get amplified within the Bitcoin community, because the Bitcoin community wants to fight these people. And I share that sentiment. Absolutely. That, you know, we want to be really engaged and push back on them. But we also, I think, have to be realistic about the fact that most politicians agree with us. And so on this topic of self-custody. And so there's not like, you know, a huge gap here between reality, the Bitcoin community, and politicians.
So you said there's a small minority, and I do agree with you, but you could make the argument they're a very powerful minority, right? So you have Elizabeth Warren, right? And not only that,
Elizabeth Warren has not enacted any substantive policies in her time in the Senate. I mean, she is a partisan hack who, you know, is very, very loud. But I mean, I think that a lot of her rhetoric is aimed towards getting money from donors, rather than actually making good policy and getting buy-in from her party and across the aisle to enact legislation. And so we see a pattern with her of, you know, every week it seems like she's going on about a different topic very passionately, right? Like she knows everything and she's got the solution to every problem. But I also just don't think that she has the attention span to kind of follow through on any particular topic. She's always seems to be coming to the next thing, whatever will get her a media soundbite, rather than her actually doing the work of passing legislation and influencing her fellow members of Congress.
Yeah, so I completely agree. But I was going to mention Elizabeth Warren and then more specifically Janet Yellen, which had, you know, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, of which Cynthia Lummis has said by name, she said this at BitBlock Boom, that the U.S. Treasury is the most hostile. Now, the way I'm going with this, Pierre, is U.S. Treasury was they, for the first time in American history, from my understanding, they did sanction open source software. And I believe what they're really trying to do is set a precedent, right? Because the reality is that Bitcoin's an open monetary network, and it is a threat to current U.S. sanction policy. The U.S. government gets a tremendous amount of power from basically being the police of money and getting to dictate what countries, what individuals are allowed to use dollars. And now Bitcoin comes along and it allows countries to potentially circumvent that. We had a lot of interest from Russia. You had a lot of interest from Iran, right? So I believe that influenced the Treasury to at least try to see if they can get away with it. And we do have an open source developer that is sitting in jail without bail in the Netherlands today for writing code, right? Which is absolutely absurd. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? On top of this, Pierre, you know, because of Ethereum centralization, it did lead. But did you see that tweet by Odell, right? That blog post led to, I think it's 60 to 70% of Ethereum validators today are actively censoring for a branch of the U.S. government, right? You know, it's absolutely crazy. So what are your thoughts on that? Because it is a very aggressive hostility, you know, completely against the First Amendment. You know, I don't know how much they care about that nowadays, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the Senator Lummis's analysis is correct, and that action from the executive branch is very different from where the legislative branch and the judicial branch are on this topic. And so ultimately, though, that has to be reconciled. And so either that can be reconciled through litigation, through the courts and the judicial process, or it can be reconciled reconciled through the legislative process of essentially passing legislation that clarifies the intent of, you know, what Congress wants executive branch agencies to be doing or not doing. And so I think both are necessary at this point. I think that if we look at the history of AML/KYC in the United States and the Bank Secrecy Act, I think that the third party doctrine is unconstitutional and violates the Fourth Amendment. So I think that either that needs to be taken to the Supreme Court and overturned, or there does need to be legislative, you know, something passed legislatively in order to protect Americans' you know, constitutional rights and the right to privacy and being able to control your own data and so on and so forth. So I think that the there is currently an imbalance that is not sustainable. So that I hope we'll see movement on. Two is that if we look at what Treasury did with the Tornado Cash Ethereum contract, I don't think it's necessarily clear that they that they're trying to do a power grab. It might have just been something clumsy on their part, where they were trying to figure out how to crack down on this. It seems like they were effective, though. So I think that raises questions. Yes, on it raises questions about, you know, is Treasury overstepping here and violating First Amendment? But it also raises question on the Tornado Cash side of, and on the Ethereum side of, if Ethereum and Tornado Cash are so decentralized and censorship resistant, why was Treasury's action effective here? And I think that it's a travesty, and it's horrifying that that developer is under custody and arrested for this contract. I don't know all the facts. That's part of the problem, is that there's not a whole lot of clarity on why he's being held, but I'd have to go dig into that. Europe is certainly more authoritarian in this regard than the United States is, and we've even seen this in terms of the conversation around Bitcoin mining with the European Commission last year. So I think that there definitely has to be some changes over there. Now with the OFAC compliance in Ethereum, I haven't seen any evidence of actual Ethereum transactions being censored. I know that they are signaling that these stakers are signaling that they would censor Ethereum transaction, but it seems as though that hasn't actually, that there isn't an example of, hey, this transaction is waiting to get confirmed, and it still hasn't been included in an Ethereum block by the stakers. Maybe the audience will correct me on this, but I haven't seen any evidence of that.
Yeah, no, it's maybe it's a matter of time. Maybe they haven't come knocking yet, but we shall see. Pierre, one of the things that I think spooked a lot of people in the community, and I wanted to get your take on that, you know, based on your experience and, you know, how long you've been in the industry, is, you know, the tragic news that Luke Dash, right? He had, you know, apparently he was hacked. He did make the claim that his coins were in cold storage. What do you think the lesson is there? What can people take from that? And most importantly, are people's coins safe in, you know, if they store it correctly with their hardware wallets?
Yeah, so I don't know all the facts. I don't know that anyone knows all the facts in this case. From the outside, it seems as though Luke had developed his own custody solution in-house. He'd rolled his own approach to custody. And I think that's all too common, especially among folks who have a lot of experience with computer security and with software and hardware, that, you know, from their perspective, that they can build something that they can trust because they are the ones who built it, and they are not having to trust a third party. I think the problem with that approach is the lack of peer review and kind of third party input, especially. So, like, for example, the hardware wallets out there on the market, the major ones, right? Ledger, Trezor, Coldcard, they have gotten a lot of attention from security researchers who are looking for vulnerabilities. It's a big badge of honor in the security industry to file a vulnerability on a hardware wallet, because it's extremely hard. So when I think about the contrast between rolling your own custody and using an off-the-shelf, commercially available, tried-and-true, you know, approach like a hardware wallet, that's gotten a lot of peer review. I think that it's better to go with a hardware wallet. And I think that one of the challenges for making that decision is one's pride versus one's humility. So I think that admitting that, hey, look, I might know a lot about computer security. I might have decades of experience with software and hardware. But the reality is that if I come up with a solution for myself, it just will not ever be as good as a solution that has been deployed at scale to millions of consumers and has been pen tested by numerous different security researchers, some of whom might be as qualified as me, if not more so, right? In all humility. And so that's where I think that it's really important to accept one's limitations and to kind of, Now, the other part of it too is that with multi-sig, you don't even necessarily have to rely on one particular hardware wallet manufacturer. So I think it makes a lot of sense if you're, you know, particularly concerned about the security mod, or sorry, the trust model with a hardware wallet manufacturer, that you do a 2 of 3 multi-sig with 3 of the different major hardware wallet manufacturers, or, you know, one of them is a software wallet or whatever you want to do. But again, the more creative you try to be, and kind of off the beaten path, because you know you know everything, the more likely that you're gonna find yourself in an edge case that is either you get hacked or you lock yourself out of your Bitcoin because you tried to be too clever.
Yeah, of course, a balance is necessary between the two. I completely agree with you. So Pierre, you know, and specifically from someone from your background, your experience, this has been a very rough year for Bitcoin miners. What would you say is the state of the industry? You know, we did have a Core Scientific massive, you know, mining operation go under. A good buddy of mine is Ben Gagnon from Bitfarms. So yeah, it's definitely been a roller coaster ride for Bitcoin miners, and you could even make an argument that it's been quite a bloodbath, really. From my perspective, you know, but I guess it's just because, you know, you've been here a couple cycles, you just start to notice patterns. It's like, this is just history repeating itself. It's just there's a lot more eyeballs and there's a lot more money involved. Are miners going to be okay? Is the industry going to be okay? Is nature healing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's no secret that Bitcoin has a volatile exchange rate, volatile purchasing power. You know, anybody getting into Bitcoin mining would understand that not only is the Bitcoin price volatile, but that mining being a derivative on top of the Bitcoin price, look, you're in for a roller coaster ride. So that's where I think it makes a lot of sense to have a capital structure strategy that is very resilient and conservative. I think that's been Riot's approach to its benefit, is steering away from leverage during the bull market, and you know, continues to not have leverage. The other part is really around the cost of mining. So if you want to build a mining operation that has a low cost, so that you have good margins in the bull market, great margins in the bull market, and then in the bear market, that you're not going into kind of negative territory where you're better off just shutting down. And so Riot's been really effective at that, namely because, one, we're in Texas, the energy capital of the world. to we have just the best construction people in the industry and outside of the industry. They are building a custom facility for Bitcoin mining. Three is the power strategy that Riot has is really focused on, how do we manage our risk just in case the electricity price were to go up, like, and indeed it has gone up, unfortunately, over the past couple of years due to natural gas prices going up and all sorts of other events in the energy industry. So the Bitcoin mining as a whole, it's not going anywhere. But the key players in the industry have to constantly be thinking about, hey, look, like bear markets are going to happen. It's not always just up and to the right. I think that as far as the overall state of the industry going into 2023, it's, as anybody can see, the Bitcoin price has gone up over the past couple of weeks. I don't know if that's sustainable or if, we're going to go sideways for a while, but in any case, it seems to have reached a bottom or to be stabilizing. It's anyone's guess. And it's all about, building something that is sustainable through the cycle. And I think Riot has succeeded at that.
Absolutely. So you said something really interesting, which is this idea of leverage, right? And I think that the companies that use leverage, not only mining companies, right? Just companies in general that have used leverage have been absolutely wrecked. I was hearing stories of miners borrowing money from now defunct Celsius and using miners themselves as collateral. How does that even work? Like, why did they even accept those types of agreements? Like, it was absolute absurdity. Was that really what caused this huge blow up at the end, right? This cascading effect of all these companies going under?
I don't think it caused that. And look, when we say a company going under, it's really, if you have a company that has too much leverage and that finds itself in default or in bankruptcy and, reorganization, it's definitely the equity holders who are suffering. But at the end of the day, it's because the Bitcoin price went down, right? Even in a situation where you don't have any leverage, when the Bitcoin price goes down, the value for the shareholders just mechanically goes down as well, because ultimately what these Bitcoin mining rigs are mining is Bitcoin.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. All right, Pierre. So I saved this because I thought this was fascinating, and I just want to get an idea of what this was like in the room. For our audio listeners, this is a screenshot that Pierre posted, and it says, I explained at JP Morgan how verifiable Bitcoin's open source monetary policy is with Node software. And again, it's just an image of Pierre in a suit, I might add, speaking to, it looks like a bunch of people that work in the banking industry. How was that like? Is there, what was the reception? I'll start with that.
Yeah, so that picture is from 2019. I dug it up because of Jamie Dimon's comments yesterday about Bitcoin. Definitely wore a suit. You got to know your audience, and when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I was up on stage with Wences from previously from Zappo. I don't know if any OGs are listening, they'll know about Zappo. It was a great conversation. I think that there's just a lot of education that needs to happen for folks to understand what Bitcoin's fundamentals are. I mean, to see Jamie Dimon on national television say that, ask the question, how do you know there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin? You know, I wish that Joe, who was answered his question, had answered it a little bit differently than he did. Joe said, well, Satoshi, and then Jamie Dimon hopped in with, yeah, how do you know Satoshi's not going to change it? You know, the answer is not about Satoshi, right? It's not an appeal to authority. It's not like, well, you know, Satoshi told us there will only be 21 million Bitcoin. Not at all. It's the fact that you can go and find the source code and read the source code and do the math, run the numbers, and see that there will only ever be less than 21 million Bitcoin. And so then you can take that source code, you can compile it and run it and verify for your own self that, hey, look, you know, so far we're only at 19 million Bitcoin, and every halving has happened. And so while, you know, the next halvings are in the future, there's zero reason to doubt that those halvings will happen. I mean, it is basically asking the question of, how do we know the sun will rise tomorrow? Look, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. You can have as much uncertainty as you want to inject into yourself there, but I guarantee you, 100%, promise you, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. And you know, you might ask yourself, is the sky going to fall? No, the sky is not going to fall, right? I also find it hilarious that Jamie Dimon's asking this question, and it's like, hey, Jamie, there's $21 trillion, pure coincidence, by the way, $21 trillion in M2 monetary policy. How do you know it's, you know, not going to be more than that? And the reality is that it's absolutely going to be more than that. It'll be $50 trillion. It'll be $100 trillion. They're going to continue to print dollars. Like, there's zero doubt about that. And so it's like, okay, on one hand, you might have some skepticism about the, you know, 32nd halving in the year 2140, but I have zero skepticism. I have zero uncertainty about the fact that they're going to print a lot more dollars within the next, you know, 5 years, right? There's zero doubt in my mind. And so, I thought it was a fascinating conversation between Jamie Dimon and CNBC hosts.
So he's not stupid. He's not a dumb guy, you know, and neither is Elizabeth Warren. Like, both of them, they're not necessarily stupid. So, and you can't say they're naive.
I've met lots of people who didn't realize like what it means that Bitcoin's open source. Like, if you're not either, you know, and I have the benefit of, in high school, I went down the rabbit hole of free and open source software. And so I was installing Linux on my parents' computer, and I was listening to Richard Stallman lectures about the rights that users should have with their software. The reality is that the mainstream, including Jamie Dimon, like, they use Windows, they only know about proprietary software. It would never cross their minds that they would, you know, that they would even want access to the source code. It would not surprise me at all if Jamie Dimon does not know that Bitcoin software is open source. He might know that Bitcoin's somehow decentralized, but he might think that it's a proprietary binary that's provided by the Bitcoin Foundation. And, you know, you've got all these computers running it, like you've got all these computers running Spotify or whatever. So I would really, you know, challenge the assumption that Jamie Dimon knows what he's talking about. And I would take him at face value, right? That he is very early on in his educational journey, but that his ego is actually stopping him from learning more. And he ended the interview that way. He said, look, I don't like this topic. I don't want to talk about this topic. And so when you're in that mindset, then you're closing yourself off from any further education And you never even get to the point where you realize, oh, this is open source software that anybody in the world can compile and can look at with their own eyeballs. And Satoshi is not going to spring a surprise on us, you know, in the year 2140.
Yeah, I mean, even if Satoshi came back, which I agree. I think it's highly improbable. Like, even if he did, it didn't change anything.
No, and there was an article from Pete Rizzo that looked into when Satoshi left the project. And Satoshi never explicitly stated why he left the project, but based on the tone of the Bitcoin Talk forums when he left the project and kind of some of his last interactions, one could make the argument that Satoshi left the project because Bitcoiners started being toxic towards him. That they were pushing back on things he was saying, and like they were not treating him like some kind of benevolent dictator or some god, you know. The toxicity driving away developers arguably starts with Satoshi Nakamoto himself. And that's why I think that even if he came back and he was like, hey, we're going to do 22 million Bitcoin, the Bitcoiners would tell him to F off, right? There's no doubt in my mind that they would, you know, be like, hey, slay your heroes. Screw this guy. What a clown. you know, tell him to have fun staying poor and that they're going to sell the fork coin, right? So that's why I love Bitcoin toxicity, by the way. I mean, even if Satoshi came back, that he would have zero power over the network and over the plebs.
Yeah, 100%. And a meme came to mind when you were saying that, you know, the Tom Hanks and the guy like, I'm the captain now.
Yeah.
the Bitcoiner is just like, I'm the captain now. That's so funny. Okay, so Pierre, do you think that it was necessary for, I believe that it was a net positive. It was a good that Satoshi stepped down, that Satoshi left, right? It's very similar to the founding of the United States, by the way. Like one of the most important things in American history was the fact that after two terms, George Washington stepped down. And that set a precedent for, you know, all, you know, really FDR kind of broke the rules, but then they finally codified it, right? Like, you know, two terms, that's it, right? So I believe that it was a good thing, right, that you took the human being, I'm glad the anonymity of Satoshi is what it is, because I think it embodies the importance of it not being about an individual or putting an individual on a pedestal, but about being a movement, about being this thing. And I don't think any other cryptocurrency, shitcoin, they haven't even come close to that. There's always a figure. There's always a person behind the project. And I think it makes Bitcoin very unique in that sense. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about Satoshi leaving?
Yeah, I mean, in many regards, it's almost miraculous. you know, I don't know of any other examples of somebody staying pseudonymous on the internet and not getting doxxed. Many have tried, right? But ultimately, there's kind of a paper trail somewhere. And to this day, Satoshi's identity remains a mystery. So I think it's excellent that he left Bitcoin. But I think he could have stayed. I don't think that, again, the toxicity is layer zero, and that it would have certainly prevented Satoshi from doing anything that would harm Bitcoin, even if he had stayed and kind of had, you know, influence and clout. It speaks to his humility. And I also think that anybody who comes along and gets interested in Bitcoin and then decides they can do something better than Bitcoin, they've got an ego, they've got pride. and They're not going to humble themselves into writing a BIP and, you know, doing a soft fork and, you know, staying in Bitcoin. They are going to create something new because of, honestly, whether it's avarice of, hey, look, I don't want to make somebody else rich by improving Bitcoin. I want to get rich. And so I'm going to have a pre-mine and a pre-allocation and all of this. Or it's kind of hubris of, oh, Bitcoin's poorly engineered. I can't fix it. Nobody can fix it. And we've got to start from scratch. Whatever it is, that it's actually great that those people have an outlet. It would be terrible if those people somehow felt like they couldn't get out of Bitcoin. So to me, the multiplicity of founder-driven altcoins is a pressure release valve at the social layer so that Bitcoin can continue to be pure and highly toxic while other coins can you know, flatter the egos of their founders.
100%. And I think that's what makes it, you know, that's what makes Bitcoin unique. That's what makes it special. That's what sets it apart. And I don't think anything's going to match that, to be perfectly frank. Anyways, Pierre.
Well, I just want to add one more thing. Sorry. I know we might be getting to time, but, this is an important lesson for Bitcoiners, which is that, look, Satoshi left, Bitcoin was fine. If you leave Bitcoin, Bitcoin will be fine. Like, don't think that you're so important that, you know, Bitcoin depends on you, which is one, you know, should humble you, but also give you a sigh of relief, right? Like, it's okay. You don't have to, you're not like Atlas, you know, holding the world on his shoulders. There's a very deep bench of talent in Bitcoin, and you don't have to feel like, hey, you need to get everything done and do everything yourself, and you know that Bitcoin's going to fail without you. So a combination of humility, but also that don't put too much pressure on yourself.
100%. Pierre, it's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much for joining me on Simply Bitcoin IRL. Where can people find you online, and why don't you tell anybody what you're working on these days?
Yeah, find me at Bitcoin Pierre on Twitter or Pierre Rochard on LinkedIn. Make sure it's not an impersonator. If they ask you how your trade is going, I guarantee you it's an impersonator. I'd never ask you that. I'd ask you, how are your savings doing?
So you're not going to send me 2 Bitcoin back?
I'm sorry. I'm keeping the Bitcoin. So working on research and education at Riot. This week I went to Texas A&M University and gave a Bitcoin guest lecture there. So I'm going to continue to do, you know, wherever I can help out with education. This past year was with Joe Burnett from Blockware on transaction fees. This year, it'll be later this year. I don't know what topic it'll be, but right now, really focused on the education aspect. So I think there's a giant information asymmetry. And, you know, we saw it with Jamie Dimon, but there's many such cases of folks who really need some mentorship and some guidance in their educational journey.
Absolutely. Well, Pierre, it's been an honor. Love to have you back on a couple months or so. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, sure thing. Looking forward to coming back.
Take care. All right, guys, that was another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. By the way, if you want more Bitcoin content, the party continues 6 p.m. in about 2 or 3 minutes. Live BTC sessions, news roundup, Pierre, thank you so much for joining us. Guys, the live show will be back tomorrow, 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Love you all. Catch you guys later.